All right. 2 years ago, almost to the day, I gave a similar lecture, and it was a hostile and inebriated audience. And I was using the Hoverman sphere, and I got my head stuck in it. So we've now gone to a safer version of the Hoverman sphere, and Peter Dorshak worked out the kinematics for this so that we could have a nice graphic here. So the title of my talk is Studies of this virus called STIV, Sulfalobus Turreted Icosahedral Virus. And really, Reza Kayat, who is someplace nearby, should be giving the talk because this is all of his work. But given the possibility of personal injury, et cetera, I volunteered to give the talk. But if there's any important questions tonight, Reza will take care of them. So this picture was from two years ago. This was not posed. Clint was indeed sound asleep during the meeting, and I think this really illustrates why it's important to have automated electron microscopy. And notice down here, this is cryo-EM in 2050. So anyway, Clint and Bridget, thank you for this great meeting and all of the wonderful things you do for us every day. And okay, so the story I'm going to tell actually started before a lot of people in the room were born. Steve Harrison's group determined the structure of tomato bushy stunt virus in 1978, and in less than 2 years later, and I remember Steve writing a little news and views thing and saying that, yes, they have finished the structure of SBMV less than 2 years after we did bushy stunt. So anyway, the important point here is that quite to my surprise, and I think to a lot of people's surprise, that the subunit fold of bushy stunt virus and southern bean mosaic virus were very, very similar eight-stranded beta sandwiches. And bushy stunt had this additional carboxy terminal protrusion that was missing in southern bean mosaic virus. But these, the folds of the subunits that formed these two particles were strikingly similar. And in fact, this eight-stranded beta sandwich was really the only subunit fold that we saw for quite a while. And it's really a beautiful structure. It's very, very simple in its topological organization. And this is how it folds up and forms viruses with various quasi-equivalent capsids, this being a T equals 1 shell. Now, for many years after that, viruses that were DNA viruses, DNA tumor viruses, SV40, insect viruses of various types, blue tongue virus, poliovirus, and rhinovirus, they all had the same fold. And we were beginning to wonder, I mean, this stretched from plant viruses to DNA tumor viruses, and it was just the same fold showing up over and over again with, in many cases, no detectable sequence similarity. So this fold was obviously very, very important in the evolution of a class of viruses. And then in the early to mid-1980s, Roger Burnett was working on the structure of adenovirus, and this is a cryo-EM reconstruction of adenovirus that came a bit later. But when Roger's group determined the subunit structure, unexpectedly, the hexon subunit contains two similar beta barrels whose topology is identical to those of the spherical RNA viruses, but whose architectural role in adenovirus is very different. So,
Jack,
yes?
On the previous slide, who's Burnett
to? Oh, sorry about that. I think I must have screwed something up there, but he's retired now, so. it actually, yeah, it's Spain that he's in, not Italy. So anyway, so what happened? One of the first structures that didn't show a single copy of this beta sandwich fold was the adenoviral subunit, and it had two copies of the beta sandwich fold, and with exactly the same topological organization as what we had seen, but now they were fused together into a single polypeptide chain. And as we'll see in a few moments, by quaternary structure, they made very good sense because these subunits were actually occupying six-fold quasi-symmetric locations in the capsid, but there were only three of them, so the fact that there were two of these beta sandwiches sort of made up for the fact that they were six-fold. So I'm not sure exactly what the history was, but I think this was the first subunit that came out that didn't have one beta sandwich but had two. But then later, much later, 13 years later, once again, now Roger Burnett, not Burnettu, was involved with Dennis Bamford to solve the structure of a bacteriophage called PRD1. And it had exactly the same fold and organization of the polypeptide chain as adenovirus. And this is kind of a curious thing because I think it's rather funny that we seem to get stuck in a rut with the structures that we look at. And then about 5 years ago, Michael Rossman's group did the structure of the major capsid protein of this very large PBCV virus that also had the same fold. So as of 2002, we saw the same fused beta sandwich in a bacterial virus, or I should say in a lower eukaryote, a bacterial virus, and in human adenovirus. And all of these had the same organization in the quaternary structure in that they would form these pseudo-hexamer, they were actually trimers, but because of the two beta sandwiches, they were pseudo-hexameric, and they would occupy these six-fold symmetry sites in the capsid of the virus. And adeno, PRD1, and PBCV all had the same sort of quaternary organization, but with a variety of detailed differences. So this is what adenovirus looks like, and here's those trimers of the major capsid protein, and this is pseudo T equals 25, and in the PRD1, it also was pseudo T equals 25, but now when we go to the PBCV, it's T equals 169, so it's a gigantic virus, 2,000 angstroms in its maximum dimension, and yet the subunit fold had exactly the same organization as had been seen in adeno and PRD1. And this is where we got into the picture. So we have viruses in the bacterial area and in the eukaryotic area, and we got the opportunity to work on a virus infecting Sulfolobus. And Sulfolobus lives under these extreme conditions, and the Sulfolobus strain that is relevant for us grows in the hot springs of Yellowstone National Park, and they grow at 80 degrees and around pH 3. Now, one of the ironies of working with a virus that lives under as an extreme thermophile is that you have to go through the snow in order to get to the sample. So here I am with Mark Young, and we are in something called a snow coach. Now, normally Mark and his colleagues go to the hot springs in snowmobiles, but given my age and frailty, they decided to rent something that was very much larger and slower. So the top speed of this is 15 miles an hour. Now, afterward, I pointed out to Mark that I drive something that has a top speed 10 times the speed of the 15 mile an hour snow coach, and that we really could have gone there in the snowmobiles. However, Now, after we reached the point near the hot springs, we had to go through hip-deep snow down into the hot spring area, and then we were confronted with a herd of bison. Now, I discovered from the guide that the two most dangerous things in the park are the hot springs and the bison. And here we are, but he said we're really in luck because only 1 out of 10 of these bison are really ornery, and there's only 9 here. So we were golden. And now we're actually got to the hot springs, of course, with appropriate celebration, and we purified the sample, and this is what we got. So this is STIV in its early incarnation and negative stain, and the particles are about 1,000 angstroms in diameter, and you could see these turrets. Mark and his colleagues sequenced the genome. It's a circular double-stranded DNA virus. With this number of base pairs, and this was the protein of particular interest to us, the capsid protein associated with this virus. Now, Liang Tang, who was in the group at the time, did the first cryo-EM reconstruction of STIV, and this is what it looked like. And of course, we were immediately struck with the sort of trimeric features that were sitting at the quasi-sixfold symmetry axes of the surface lattice, and we were also struck with the large decorations that were located at the pentamers. So with this very simple initial reconstruction, at 27 angstroms resolution, the particles had a maximum dimension of 1,000 angstroms, including the turrets. And then without the turrets, it had a maximum dimension of about 740 angstroms, and the shell had a thickness of 64 angstroms. And the quasi-symmetry of the particle was T equals 31. So Liang generated this with our Viper website, but then we were really struck with the fact that he could take the coordinates of this idealized quasi-symmetric shell and just superimpose them directly onto the actual quaternary structure of the virus. And the rigidity of this was very, very striking, how it matched the theoretical description. So it had T equals 31 symmetry, and we immediately started to think about comparing it with the other viruses that I told you about. And in many ways, it's quite similar. One of the things that's very interesting about these is the presence of a membrane. And PRD1 has an internal membrane. Adenovirus has no membrane. And PBCV also has an internal membrane. And it was pretty clear from even the very initial reconstruction that was done that this virus also had an internal membrane in which the subunits were attached. And it's the only one of the group that has circular DNA, but the size is really fairly comparable to both PRD1 and adenovirus. So we were pretty confident that we were looking at another member of this general family of double-barrel organized capsid proteins, but now in a different incarnation and certainly in a very different host being in the archaeal. And if you take the purified virus particles and run an SDS gel on them, you characterize about 8 different gene products that are in these particles. And the dominant one is this coprotein gene, which was designated B345. And Reza, when he came into the lab, cloned this gene product or this gene and was able to express it in E. coli and was able to get nice crystals diffracting to about 2 angstroms resolution and was able to solve the structure by SAD phasing methods. And which then refined to quite reasonable R factors and so forth and so on. And the density that we got for the subunit was very nice, and everything fit very beautifully as far as the sequence and so forth. And to I don't think anyone's surprise, when we looked at the organization of this subunit, it indeed had the double barrel organization that had been seen in these other viruses. Now I should point out that there's not a trace of any sequence similarity in the structure of STIV and the other viruses. And if you superimpose STIV on PBCV, the superposition is just absolutely striking. So with the lack of any type of sequence similarity, you still have just virtually superimposable tertiary structures of these two capsid proteins. Now, in all of the other structures that had been solved, the protein had been purified from the virus. This was the first of the structures to be done where the protein was expressed in a heterologous expression system. And in each case, the proteins, as they crystallized, were in this hexameric form. However, in Reyes's structure, the subunits were monomeric. They were not in the hexamer. So Reyes then generated this model of STIV, of the STIV trimer, based on PRD1, and then used this as a means of fitting to the to the electron density that had been generated from the cryo-EM reconstruction. And two different approaches were used. One, the hexamers were kept as a rigid unit and were refined into the cryo-EM density. And in the other, the hexamers were allowed to move independently. And very similar refinements were obtained, but if you looked at the fit to the electron density by releasing the constraint of the hexamer, you actually got a significantly better fit. So now this is the refined structure these are the two refined structures. One, obviously they're very, very similar to each other, but they fit very beautifully into the cryo-EM density of the entire particle. So it was then possible to create a model based on the X-ray structures of the icosahedral asymmetric unit of STIV. And this now compares Reyes's model with the actual cryo-EM reconstruction. And there's 31 subunits in the icosahedral asymmetric unit. Now, this is just a cross-section through the virus, through the cryo-EM reconstruction, and we were struck very early on with the sort of bilayer appearance just inside the capsid protein. And as we'll show in a few minutes, this has been verified to be a membrane that, in fact, the protein is firmly attached to in the structure. And if we do a radial distribution function, we can see the inner and outer layers of this internal membrane. But at this point in time, it was somewhat inconclusive, I would say. So now here's a difference map where the density for the X-ray model has been subtracted from the cryo-EM model with all the appropriate scaling and so forth. And now we see this inner layer, the red inner layer, which, as we'll show you in a few moments, is actually the outer layer of the membrane. But we also can see another gene product that's very nicely organized around the pentameric structures associated in this region here. And one of the things that was very, very satisfying was that this P6 protein of 19.8 kilodaltons and known to exist inside in the particle actually is very, very nicely accommodated in this volume of density associated with the pentamers. The other part that was very satisfying was the fact that the C-terminal regions of the subunits were invisible in the X-ray electron density map, present but invisible. And this is where the X-ray model ended. And in the cryo-EM reconstruction with the best fit, it was clear that the C-terminal helices are probably accommodated very nicely in this in these regions of density that bulge out of the membrane. So everything about the structure was really very satisfying in terms of the blending of the information from cryo-EM and the X-ray model. These protrusions are extraordinarily large and interesting. 244 angstroms in their dimension across, and they extend by 205 angstroms up from the surface of the membrane or the surface of the particle. And these regions here, which we call the petals of the flowers, are interesting from work that we subsequently did. So this is just the X-ray model put into the density, and then adding the pentons, and then the final portion of the X-ray model that surrounds the pentons to give us the final structure. Now, in parallel with the work that we were doing, our colleagues at the University of Montana were characterizing the other features of these virus particles. And this work was led by Brian Bothner at Montana. And they were able to essentially do a sort of proteomics analysis of the virus. And just again, this was the SDS gel, which they then analyzed by mass spectrometry, each of the bands, and were able to conclusively assign the different gene products to these bands. Now, one of the interesting things was that if you treated the capsid protein with different deglycosidase enzymes, the enzymes that would deglycosidase O-links had no effect on the mass of the capsid protein, but those that deglycosidated N-linked clearly removed some sugars and generated a lower molecular weight mass. And this is important for what I'll show you in a few minutes. Also, they analyzed the lipid content of the sulfolobus membranes themselves, coming up with this type of a distribution of lipids. And interestingly, when the virus particles were analyzed, they had enriched the membrane associated with the virus with this lipid and with this lipid. So the virus, during its assembly process, is actually enriching the membrane in particular aspects of the host membrane. Now, we did a very carefully controlled experiment in which material was sent to us from Montana and then traveled, we don't know exactly where, but a very long distance in the UPS or Federal Express. But anyway, it was gone for a matter of about a week or so. And when Reza got this material and did the cryo-EM reconstruction on it, now at considerably higher resolution, we seem to have lost something in the trip. The petals have fallen off of the pentons, and as we'll see, there's some other interesting features. Now, if you lower the contour level of these, you start to see some pentons, some petals on here. So you haven't really lost all of them, but you've lost a pretty sizable fraction of them. But the rest of the particle was very well organized. And in fact, again, if you do this radial distribution of the electron density, the bilayer now is much more strikingly defined in these particles that had had an extended travel time. And if you compare the densities of the normal virus that had been prepped and studied very quickly. I was in Brown. The membrane seems to have actually shrunk some in the particles that had spent quite a bit of time at room temperature. It's interesting, these things live in boiling acid, but if they sit around too long at room temperature, they start to do unusual things. So now, once again, Reza modeled the subunits into the density associated with the revised version. This is the original reconstruction that was done that I showed you before, but now the membrane has actually dropped significantly away, and now this density that would be assigned to helices is kind of suspended in midair. What's more, there's clear density for the glycosylation sites on the surface of the subunits. So the difference density now revealed the locations of these glycosylation sites. And this just shows a blown-up version of the relationship between the older, or I should say the more compacted membrane region and the additional features of the outer portion of the capsid. So adenovirus capsids, these adenovirus-like capsids, they're all double-strand DNA viruses. They all are characterized with T numbers from 25 to 169. They have large T numbers. All of the subunits contain this double barrel fold. The subunits form trimers that are these pseudohexamers satisfying the six-fold symmetry sites in the quasi-capsids. The particles have these larger T numbers. All of them have protruding pentons. All but adenovirus have an internal membrane. And the question is, in PRD1, David Stewart and his colleagues have identified something that they call the tape measure protein that may determine what the T number or what the quasi-symmetry of these capsids are, but in none of the other structures do we have sufficient resolution to be able to look at a comparable protein. So this is just now a comparison of the STIV capsid protein with PRD1. This is a structure that I believe is now in press from David Stewart's lab. It's another bacterial virus, PM2, and it also has the same double barrel fold, PBCV, the chlorella virus, and then, of course, adenovirus with the more elaborate structure. So the organization of these viruses with the same capsid fold are bacterial viruses that are listed here. Archaeoviruses, there's another candidate virus that has icosahedral symmetry. I should say most of the archaeoviruses tend to be rod-shaped viruses. The icosahedral viruses are rather exceptional in the archaeal family. But there is another one called halovirus SH1 that may well be in this same family. And then the lower eukaryotes, the MIMI virus is the current largest virus that's been identified, and it's quite likely that it will have a capsid protein similar in the organization as the ones that I've described. And then there's invertebrate viruses that are also related to PBCV that infect a variety of hosts. So the lineage, then, of the relationships between these, we've got the double-strand DNA viruses in this PRD1 category of particles. There's double-stranded RNA viruses that include blue tongue virus, Phi-6, and a variety of other double-strand RNA viruses. And then there's this tailed double-strand DNA viruses that have a completely different fold than what we see up here. And it turns out that these are probably all closely related to each other by their capsid protein fold as well. And that would include herpes virus, so we also have a virus in the eukaryotic family too that seems to fit into this general picture. So what this means in terms of the way these virus particles have evolved is anybody's guess. I've never been any good at being able to make cogent arguments of this, but there's certainly some very interesting ideas that are being put forward these days about the role that viruses have actually played in the transition from the RNA world to the DNA world, and the place where these viruses have actually started in terms of their infectivity of these various hosts that range through all the kingdoms of life. So I want to certainly acknowledge Reza Kayat, who did 95% of the work that I described here, and Liang Tang, who really got the project started. And then we've had a great collaboration with Mark Young, Brian Bothner at Montana State, and Dennis Bamford is always an enthusiastic cheerleader for any of the discussions that come up. And with that, I'll thank you for your attention, and if there's any questions, Reza will answer them. So. Well, I'm considered my the well-being of my audience. So, well, just I was outside talking to one of the people here, and he said, "You know, everybody seems to always fill the time designated to them." So I just want to go on record as not filling the time designated to me, and also that Ken can leave for his red eye without missing any of my talk. Yes.
Is there any idea about those structures you see on top of the fivefold, those vertex, what function all those proteins have?
Well, they're almost certainly involved with some type of cell attachment activity. PRD1, there's a lot of work that's been done with this virus now that shows that that the internal membrane actually generates like a tail structure through which the DNA gets delivered. There's some Dennis Bamford and his colleagues have some very, very beautiful electron micrographs of these particles actively infecting, and they create a tail out of that internal membrane. And those tails appear to be coming out of the these pentameric structures. So it's likely that it's an attachment and a delivery function associated with those, and it would be certainly interesting to get a lot more information about the proteins that comprise that. There's probably at least two gene products that are in those shells, one of which we know what it looks like because we managed to have it fall off, but the other one we're not sure.
I have another question.
Good.
How about those helices that you see in the membrane?
Mm-hmm. Well, the helices that are going into the membrane actually correspond to the C-terminus. I mean, according to our interpretation, they correspond to the C-terminus of the capsid protein. Because in Reza's X-ray structure, those are invisible, and they are apparently disordered. But when you can superimpose those structures into the density of the cryo-EM reconstruction, the visible C-terminus of the X-ray model stops right where those bulges are sticking out. So I think it's a very safe conclusion that those correspond to the C-terminal helices that are actually embedded into the membrane. You agree with that, Reza? Good. Well, that's always a good question, and we obviously imposed it, but I would say that the average density for those structures is comparable to the average density for any other part of the of the reconstruction. So I don't think we have been too insulting to the authentic structure with the averaging process. And I mean, certainly the features all make pretty good sense being pentameric.
Mm-hmm. Around the region of interest and proceed with an asymmetric reconstruction. And that might help to use some asymmetric features. But if that procedure is applied and we still reproduce that pentameric feature, then that's a good indication that that region indeed originally had such a feature.
Mm-hmm. No, I think it's very worthwhile to treat these things asymmetrically. I was just at a meeting with Michael Rossman last week, and he was showing a number of features of icosahedral viruses that are apparently asymmetric in terms of the way they bind receptors, and so we're very likely disturbing some of the biologically significant features by the averaging process. And I think it's really important that we keep that in mind, because these are going to be subtle differences, and we need some powerful tools to be able to tease those out. Steve.
About
what?
About the lipids.
Mm-hmm.
They're monolipids, they're not bilipids. Meaning that you don't have two different chains connected to each other.
Okay.
It's a single layer, and they have a lot of cyclopentyl groups in it. And they're also saturated.
They're novel lipids, I believe, that associated with the archaeal.
They're ethers rather than estrogens.
I see. But there is a, in other words, I guess if you, maybe the questions all revolve, I guess, around the blue and brown slide or something that showed the lipid bilayer in the partly degraded particles.
The FedEx sample.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Well, let's see. I'm sorry. Well, I guess we. Ah, yeah. Okay. So this is what it looked like in the earlier version. And then they were just kind of in suspended animation in the FedEx version.
So, but I guess I don't. In the one on the left, in the pre-FedEx version, where do you imagine the bilayer to be?
I would assume that it's starting right in here. Do you agree, Raisa? Okay. Going in. So this is the outer layer here, and these helices are associated with it, with the outer portion of the bilayer.
And they're sequenced
It's actually, what, positively charged,
it's
isn't it?
Basic. It has a basic.
Right.
And so, I see, so that it can't be that that because there's no density for head groups if they're not very dense, that the bilayer, if they were hydrophobic, I was just wondering if the bilayer actually begins at the top of those little...
No, I think the working hypothesis is that the basic nature of the C-terminus is just orienting these helices against the outer bilayer.
I see. Okay.
And then everything kind of drops down in the version. Yeah, I mean we're pretty vigorously waving our hands here about what the details are, but this is what the density looks like. Yes, Richard.
So how do you grow these viruses? Do you actually grow them?
Well, we don't grow them, obviously, since they're traveling around the country before they get. No, they're grown in Mark Young's lab, and they have a wonderful strain now of Sulfolobus that grows beautifully under 80 degrees pH 3, and they can produce virus reasonably well, although it's still not particularly dependable. But it's an interesting laboratory with a lot of humidity with all
the viruses are infected also at 80 degrees pH.
Yes, right. And these viruses also have an extracellular part of their life cycle. I mean, they're not like some yeast viruses that stay associated with the host all of the time and are actually almost like a little organelle. These bud out and they are existing under these 80 degrees pH 3 conditions as independent entities. So they're not protected by the cell. No, I don't think they are. Damn, questions. they're remarkably fragile, actually. I mean, I guess it's rather frustrating because, in fact, they're so robust in their native environment, and yet they're relatively fragile under the conditions we try to work with them. Yes. That razor has the answer.
And Dr. Copper is all.
Maybe that's the problem we've been having, razor.
they're unstable at pH 7. They fall apart. So they're shipped to us at the citrate buffer at pH 2. And they're put on the grid at pH 2.
Not really. One of the things that Reza pored over in great detail was the features of the amino acid composition and so forth with respect to the tertiary structure. And I think you came up with some higher fraction of prolines in loops, but it's a fairly subtle. It's not something that leaps out at you. So I think, like almost all of these features, it's much more statistical than very specific that you can point to and say this is why this thing is so stable under these conditions.
Jack, how does the capsid behave under power?
I don't think it's been looked at in that regard, as far as I know. I don't think. Yep.
Check the pH after they were shipped to you. They picked up CO2, but
I did not check it, but the document said there was shipped 100 more, million more citrate. So I assume that was higher up for sustaining.
All right. Well, thank you, folks, for being patient with us, and thank you, Bridget and Clint and Ron, for letting me speak again.
Thanks.